Next case and last case on our oral calendar this morning is A24-1908, Ryan Grant Appellant versus State of Minnesota Respondent. Counsel, as you well know, 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Please state your name and the party you represent. 5 minutes rebuttal for appellant. Arguments are being live streamed, and we will maintain an audio version for our public website. And counsel for appellant, take your time to set up, but whenever you're ready, just adjust the podium, and we are ready for you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Mr. Grant this morning. There are two issues before the court in this matter. First, whether the district court erred by denying Mr. Grant's petition based only on his conduct of handing Mr. Griffin a firearm before the robbery. And second, whether the district court erred by not holding a hearing on Mr. Grant's petition. I will start with the first issue, and I'm happy to pivot to the second issue at any time. After representing clients in courtrooms across the state of Minnesota on petitions to vacate aiding and abetting felony murder convictions, I can confidently state that the facts of every one of these cases are troubling. In every aiding and abetting felony murder case, multiple people plan to commit a serious violent felony. There is a tragic loss of life, and a deadly weapon is ordinarily used to cause the death of the victim. While these cases are all tragic, the legislature has made the policy determination to ensure that individuals in the underlying felony crime are punished for their conduct, but not the conduct of the person who made the decision to pull the trigger and end the life of the victim.
Clarification as far as your argument is concerned, and I understand how this comes up, but did you concede that Grant was a major participant, and the focus of your argument is that he that there wasn't a demonstration that he disregarded or was indifferent to life? Or are you arguing both?
Based on the record that we have now, without having the hearing, we are only arguing that he did not act with extreme indifference to human life. So we're not contesting the findings based on the record at this point. The narrow question in this case.
Let me ask you this. You didn't ask for a hearing. So I know that's the second part of this, but if you're bringing it up in that fashion, I mean, don't you have to ask for a hearing? Because the way the statute reads, the judge can have a hearing.
No, the statute states that the court shall order a hearing. This is not the post-conviction statute, and the way this is operated literally in every case we've handled.
District court shall, one, issue an order, two, issue an order denying, or schedule the matter for hearing.
Yep. So.
So it kind of has options.
Right, based on the case. So under that first provision, if the state agrees with our petition, then the court sets the case for sentencing. If under the second provision, if the state court realizes based on new information that there's not a reasonable probability, which is the standard for the preliminary application, then it can summarily deny the petition as if it was denying the preliminary application. But in any other case where the court is not making a finding under the second provision, the case has to have a hearing.
All right, what about the decision that was issued in the companion State versus Griffin? Because in State versus Griffin, it seems as if the court teased out that this was akin to a petition for post-conviction relief, which means you have a hearing if it so warrants having a hearing, an evidentiary hearing.
So for appellate purposes, whether an appellate court has jurisdiction, the Supreme Court has determined that they will treat this as an appeal as it's a post-conviction petition. But the legislature could have written the act as if it was a post-conviction petition, but it did not. Instead, it laid out very different provisions that are different than the post-conviction statute, Chapter 590. And under this provision, every case where there's a petition filed and the state does not agree goes to a hearing. At that hearing,
why is that not Why does paragraph 2 of that part not apply here?
Because
issue an order denying it if the additional submissions establish there's not a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief and include a memorandum identifying. You're saying that that one does not apply here, that paragraph? Why?
And I'll give you two reasons. First, generally speaking, and I can just take a step back for how this all works, is somebody the petitioner will originally file a preliminary application. To get to the petition phase, you have to establish that you were convicted under the right statute and that you're in custody.
You got to that. We know you got to that.
Yep.
Quam heard it, and you went from there.
That's right, but I think that's important background for my next comment. So we got through that. Now, there are cases that I've handled where let's say a defendant files a pro se application from prison, and the judge agrees and says, well, you can file a petition. Then the judge gets the petition, and the judge realizes, oh, this person was convicted of first-degree premeditated murder, or this person was convicted of second-degree intentional murder, and then can deny the petition because after looking at new information, realizes that there's not a reasonable probability that that person is entitled to relief. So then they can summarily deny the petition because they shouldn't even have gotten that far.
So what would you, if you had a hearing, what would you get? I mean, all the information was presented. We have the trial transcript. We have the exhibits, the documents. What more would have been provided?
Well, I'm not going to get into the details of my conversations with my client, but my client will be testifying at that hearing. He has the right to testify, especially regarding the extreme indifference prong, which has to do with his mental state and what was going on at the time he handed the gun to Mr. Griffin and why he handed the gun and what he knew at that moment. And that goes directly to whether he acted with extreme indifference to human life. So we have the opportunity to present him as a witness and present other witnesses as well.
So getting back to paragraph 2, you gave an example where a judge gets something and says, not only is there no reasonable probability, you should never have even gotten that far. Let's leave that example aside, you know, like it's the wrong crime or whatever. But why doesn't paragraph 2 on its face apply where the judge can make a decision that there's not a reasonable probability of entitlement to relief? What are you saying that means? Like, you're...
Right. So your original statement, you said that there's not a reasonable probability and they would not have been, their application would have been granted.
You gave a hypothetical where you said, it should not have even been granted.
Yep.
As examples you've seen. I was like, all right, let's leave that one aside because that's beyond reasonable probability. It's for sure if the judge decides you had the wrong crime or something.
Right.
But why doesn't 2 apply here where a judge looks at filings and decides there's not a reasonable probability?
Two reasons. One is the standard for the petition is preponderance of the evidence. So it's a different standard. Second, Judge Quam made a finding, only applied the preponderance of the evidence standard, did not make a finding under that provision that there was not a reasonable probability that he was entitled to relief. So specific to this case, Judge Quam did not make a finding and deny the petition based on that.
So you're saying that Judge Quam didn't do either paragraph 2 or paragraph 3?
Right, that's correct. So we've had cases where the judge will say, we've received the petition, I've looked on Mensis or I've looked at the sentencing order, and I've realized now that the petitioner was convicted of first-degree murder. I'm going to deny it under subdivision 2 or the second provision there. And in this case, Judge Quam weighed the evidence and made findings on the merits and determined that we did not prove by a preponderance of the evidence. And you can't make that determination, or Judge Quam can't make that determination without having a hearing.
If we look at petitioners, I think there was a memorandum of law or something like that, written argument filed in the district court, am I right?
With the petition, that's correct.
If we look at that, does the petition argue or contemplate a future hearing? Does it say that when we get to the hearing, you know, does it make any kind of general proffer, or does it simply refer to the existing evidentiary materials and argue based on them? I think you're admitting there is no expressed request for a hearing.
That's right. Yeah, our argument, yeah, there was no request for a hearing because there's no requirement to request a hearing.
Well, that's to be determined, maybe, right?
Well, I suppose you get the last word on that, but the way that the legislature wrote the statute, there is no ability of the court to deny and find rule on the merits without a hearing.
But the whole concept of forfeiture generally is often courts courts impose a requirement, you know, that parties have to generally have to ask for what they want, I guess. But anyway, what I'm getting back to is I'm wondering whether the even if there wasn't an express request for a hearing, whether there's something in the memorandum that could be construed as or could reflect an understanding of petitioner's counsel that there would be a hearing and you know an expectation and maybe should have caused the district court to say, you know, to inquire or to raise the issue.
Our position is that by filing a petition and raising arguments and requesting that the client gets relief, that in itself triggers the next step, which is a hearing. And those hearings, like I've said, every case other than Hennepin County, we have had these hearings. We file these petitions, the court grants, reads the statute and says, we're gonna have a hearing. We go in for the hearing. Sometimes it's just oral argument. Sometimes it's a discussion of how the statute is working because the judge wants to know more about it. And sometimes we put on witnesses and they give testimony and then the judge makes a determination and then we go to resentencing. So that's just how it works. And that's different than in post-conviction review because in post-conviction review, there's a burden to prove to get a hearing and that just doesn't exist under the statute.
So you're telling me that, so I'm reading the Subdivision 6 kind of describes a progression of events. Did petitioner file a reply?
Yep.
And so then there's a 30-day period for the court to take the next step. And so you or whoever was counsel then were waiting for either the order under paragraph 1, 2, or 3, and instead you got this.
That's correct. And one wasn't going to apply because the state didn't agree. Two wasn't going to apply because the court didn't find that there wasn't a reasonable probability he's entitled to relief. So the only thing the court can do is three. Another way to look
but
at it
the
is
court,
there is no provision that gives the court the discretion to issue an order without a hearing.
But if the court looked at what was filed and thought, I mean, what is the standard for deciding a reasonable probability of relief? I mean, is it that unlike a post-conviction, if it's just on the face of it, shows X, you don't have to go to a trial on X or a hearing on X because on the face of it, taking it, you know, I mean, we know the standard for post-conviction. But if here you looked at the filing and said, on what is before me, the person was a major participant acting with extreme indifference, then why can't paragraph 2 let the judge make that decision there? I mean, I know the court didn't use the word reasonable probability. In fact, it said, this is what this shows, what was presented to me shows this, mm-hmm. And not something else.
Right.
Then why can't they make a decision under 2?
Yeah, so a couple responses. First, I'll get directly to the fact what happened here is we have the burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. We can only do that at a hearing.
Why? Why can't you present enough to show there's some basis for a hearing? You can't just go in and say, I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to submit nothing. Or can you?
So we file our petition. We cite to the record.
Uh-huh.
We cite to the transcript, the plea transcript.
Uh-huh.
And then the court reviews that. And then we can then present evidence at the hearing to establish preponderance of the evidence.
Okay,
now,
so State versus Griffin, that was Supreme Court. That's the guy that's with Grant. He didn't have a hearing, and the Supreme Court akin it again to a petition for post-conviction relief. So how can you step out of Griffin not having a hearing and say, oh, gee, this is a guy that was involved, but he should have had a hearing?
That's
how do you distinguish
it? It's a great example because Mr. Griffin's preliminary application was denied, not his petition. He filed a pro se preliminary application, and because he wasn't convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder.
Didn't the Supreme Court comment on the procedure and its opinion? And I wish I had it in front of me, and I don't, and I didn't bring my laptop in.
No, because that's the preliminary application phase. So he filed a pro se preliminary application, and it was denied. That's what he is appealing. Ours was granted. So now we're in the preponderance of the evidence standard. And to go back to Judge Smith's question earlier, the standard for a reasonable probability, if you look to Subdivision 1 of the Act, it states that the legislature's, the purpose of the statute is to allow a defendant who is convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder who is in custody to petition the district court for relief. So the standard, what the reasonable probability standard is not a burden of proof or an evidentiary standard. It is purely, was he convicted of the right under the right statute and is he in custody? So then we get to the petition phase.
Yeah, interesting is that doesn't seem so reasonable probability to me. That seems like absolute. If you're not, if you haven't been convicted of the right statute, you know what I mean? It's not a weighing of probabilities. It just it is or is not. I think what you're suggesting is there's no burden of production whatsoever at the petition stage.
Except for establishing, oh, sorry.
Burden of production even.
At the preliminary application phase?
No, at the petition phase.
We have a burden of proof.
Right.
At the petition phase. At the preliminary application phase, and let me just be clear, there are cases, so that reasonable probability standard, it does come into play because there are situations where a defendant has been in prison for 30 years. He files a pro se application written in pencil with no citations, nothing. The district court goes to the record. There's nothing on Mincis because it's such an old case. So the judge has to make a determination of whether there's a reasonable probability that that person was convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder and is still in custody. They grant the application. Then it's assigned to us, the public defender's office. We look at the case. We file the petition. Then at that point, if the judge determines that, hey, he was actually convicted of first-degree premeditated murder, he pulled the trigger, then they can deny it under that second provision. And
so
it goes
the
away.
Second one is a very, very narrow thing, and
that's
you
right.
don't have a burden of production there even to show that the substantive standards were.
There's not two different standards once you get to the petition phase. It is you need to prove it by the preponderance of the evidence. The reasonable
right, prove what though? You're saying that
I
have whether to the right crime.
So the petition process, I have to. If I could answer.
Yep. Go ahead.
In the petition process, I have to prove that my client was not a major participant.
Right.
And did not act with extreme indifference to human life. In the preliminary application phase, I have to prove that my client was convicted under the right statute and is still in custody.
Okay.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Appreciate it.
And counsel for respondent.
Thank you and good morning again. My name is Elizabeth Scoggin. I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney.
Do you want to put that down just a little bit? The lectern so that, wait, do you see where it is? There, and you won't be covered up by the microphone. Great, thank you.
Didn't want to necessarily emphasize how much shorter I am than appellant's counsel. So, first, this is a case clearly showing extreme indifference to human life. The facts are overwhelming and clear and represented in the record, both in State v. Griffin, the Supreme Court opinion referenced by Judge Warkey, and in his testimony in that trial. I want to make clear that the characterization of the facts as a person who is just standing in the backyard where a gun is used is an underdevelopment of the facts in this case. This is a person who decided to go commit robberies with a co-defendant. He decided to scout the location of those victims based on the race of those victims and their likelihood or lack of likelihood of reporting to the police. He hands off not just a dangerous weapon, but the most dangerous kinds of weapon, a firearm, to his co-defendant. He is present when the shooting happens in the backyard. He runs away. He does not render aid. He then sells the weapon. He is dishonest with the police and then ultimately decides to come around. All of these factors clearly support Judge Quam's finding that Mr. Grant was clearly and unequivocally indifferent.
It was also established there was children in the backyard.
Yes, absolutely. It's as many factors as you can possibly imagine. I know Respondent's Counsel is very familiar with this statute and referenced his handling these cases across the state. Hennepin County is obviously also the county where the majority of these cases are coming from. In some cases, my office has agreed to preliminary applications or has conceded after a preliminary application has been granted, for the girlfriend who is sitting in the car when the shooting happens, or the person who handed off the gun 4 days ahead of time. This just isn't that case.
So let's talk process. When, I think, as I understand the argument from the appellant is, once you've proceeded to the petition phase, when can a judge act under paragraph 2 at the petition phase to decide that there's not a reasonable probability of success? And isn't the submission I'm trying to place in the context of what does this mean for, do you have to take, you know, any evidence? Does it have to be undisputed? Do you have to take in light most favorable? What do you do in them? Or do you just go to a hearing because it's been, the appellant has a burden of proof and they want to put on evidence to show that they did not have that mental state?
I think that you just look at the plain language of the statute. The statute does not say only that the court needs to determine that there is not a reasonable probability that the applicant is not entitled to relief. It says if additional information or submissions establish there is not a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief under this section. Those additional submissions refer directly back to the submissions in subdivisions 6A, B, and C, which says the additional submissions that the state can provide are the police reports, trial transcripts, plea transcripts, and although we are not obligated to provide that additional information, that is our first opportunity to provide information to the court past the preliminary application stage. So when reading subdivision 2, the answer is that the court can look at those additional submissions, the trial transcripts, and other information in the record, and determine that there is not a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief. That's what Judge Quam did here.
But did he use those? Did he use the words reasonable probability?
He did not, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct. He did not use those words, but we assume that judges are following the law. So the fact that he looked at those additional submissions and then decided to not schedule the matter for a hearing because those additional submissions plainly showed that there was not a reasonable probability that the applicant was entitled to relief is sufficient.
In your brief, on page 20 of your brief, you are arguing also that the question of whether there was to be a hearing is forfeited. Can you explain whether we should reach that as a decision or whether this is even properly before us?
I absolutely stand by my argument on page 20. There's no request for a hearing. There are multiple opportunities to request for a hearing. There is, of course, a preliminary filing. There is then a filing on the merits, and then there is a reply brief. And the idea that everyone was waiting to get a hearing scheduled is simply not supported anywhere in the record. There's no motion to reconsider. There's no motion to request a hearing. It just doesn't exist anywhere in the record. I would also note that appellant's counsel mentioned that at a hearing he would be able to present testimony about his client's state of mind. One, that testimony is contained in the trial transcript and in the facts noted in State v. Griffin, and two, it's first mention of what potential information could be elicited at a hearing. It just simply, the court doesn't need to come to that conclusion because it doesn't exist anywhere in the record. So I do think that there does not need to be a hearing on the merits, and there's no evidence that anything that could potentially be offered at that hearing would change Judge Quam's conclusion.
In your experience, which of course is, I take it is limited to Hennepin County,
that's correct.
Have there been orders issued by judges under paragraph 3 setting cases for hearings?
In fact, the last time I conferenced with my colleague who handles the majority of these, there have never been hearings granted, not a single one.
But there could be.
You're absolutely.
Not saying that there can.
No. Yes, I do not want to overstate my claim here.
This is not the case where there would be.
Yes.
I mean, if he'd asked for one, was the judge able to deny that?
If the judge reviews under 2 and says these additional submissions, the police reports, trial transcripts, et cetera, do not establish a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief, then no, there's no need for a hearing. But if they conclude then that a hearing and additional submission of evidence or identification of witnesses is necessary, for example, if a person had only pled guilty to aiding and abetting felony murder and had not testified in a different case where you have this ample description of what happened that the day in question. All you had was the plea petition, which is only required to establish, you know, the elements of the facts. You then may want to expand the record to argue about the details of what happened that day to determine whether there was extreme indifference to human life and a major participant. But again, this isn't that case. We have a Supreme Court opinion. We have trial testimony. We have the plea transcript. There's nothing more to talk about.
What is the standard? Leave aside whether one can forfeit a hearing by not asking for it. What is the standard that a court should follow in deciding between acting pursuant to paragraph 2 based on submissions and, or sending it to 3? What is the general standard that you would say applies? When does a district court have to do 3 and send it to versus 2?
So if the petition establishes a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief under that section, so the additional submissions indicate there are some additional questions that the judge needs to ask or additional information that needs to be gathered. I think subdivision 3, the exact words are an order regarding submission of evidence or identification of witnesses. Then it certainly can order a hearing. And I'm certainly not saying that Judge Quam could not have ordered a hearing in this case.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what they have to do. And
yes.
Because the argument is it had to. And the argument, I mean, paragraph 2 doesn't talk about the appellant having the obligation to show a reasonable probability if it shows there was not a reasonable probability that you're entitled. So it's just you just repair back to that reasonable probability question. Even if it's, so you can, a district court could resolve, for example, at paragraph 2, some credibility differences if there, you know, what if there is an affidavit from the appellant saying, no, this is not what was in my, you know, something like that. I mean, how do credibility disputes or weighing evidence and all of that figure into paragraph 2?
I think that is a very good question. I think if there were some facts in dispute or some credibility determinations to be made, it does make sense to hold a hearing. But again, that just isn't this case because we do have sworn testimony under oath. So I do think that, yes, if there is not a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief, a judge is entitled to say, no, thank you. We don't need to go any further. But if there are conflicting witness statements or additional testimony that needs to be elicited, and in this case, again, the first mention I've heard of that is today, that provision just, we don't need to go any further than step 2. So in this particular case, I don't think that's necessary. But I do think you're right. If there is a credibility determination to be made, there is a proffer of some kind of additional witnesses that they desire to have testify, that step 3 does make sense to schedule the matter for a hearing.
Can either party submit information, both the state and the appellant, at this stage?
Yes.
So
the subdivision 6 allows not only the state, but the applicant can provide other relevant information, including police reports, trial transcripts, plea transcripts. And while the prosecutor does not have to provide any additional information, we can provide additional substantive information. So appellant's counsel is correct that the first step is very bare bones. It is just, I was convicted under this statute, I'm in custody. And then the second step allows everyone to put everything in front of the judge that they need to see, police reports, trial transcripts, et cetera. And in this case, the only additional evidence submitted was by the state, even though both parties could do.
My next question. The state supplied all the information?
Yes. There were no police reports supplied by appellant. It was only argument on paper. That was it. So no affidavits, no this is what my client may or may not say, this is what another witness may or may not say. It just wasn't there. It was a purely legal argument based on the facts presented by the state. And in that case, Judge Quam decided that there was not a reasonable probability that the applicant was entitled to relief.
Functionally decided that by saying no.
Assuming he was following the law, yes, that is functionally what he said. And I think his findings of fact firmly support that. So because he did correctly assess that this person evinced extreme indifference to human life, I think that there is no need for a hearing, and Judge Quam's decision should be affirmed.
So I guess, should we take it from your argument that, I mean, you would agree there is no fourth type of order? There's three types of orders, three pigeonholes, so to speak. We have to put it into one of them, and there's no opportunity for a district judge to make a ruling on the merits, to make a denial on the merits without a hearing.
No. My argument is that it can make a ruling on the merits under paragraph 2 after receiving the supporting documentation, including police reports, trial transcripts, and plea transcripts.
Okay, maybe that's a fair answer. Let me refine my question. Is it... May a district court, without reviewing or reconsidering the decision made at the preliminary application stage, may a district court consider all submissions, all information in front of it, and then make a final decision with either findings of fact or conclusions of law on the merits?
Yes, and I don't, and I...
But that would be a fourth order other than the three that are described, right?
So I want to be clear that I don't agree with appellant's characterization that paragraph 2 about reasonable probability is simply a revisiting of an earlier preliminary screening process.
Well, that is the standard. that is the standard at the preliminary application phase, right?
At the preliminary application phase, it is a reasonable probability of success on two entirely different things, whether in custody or convicted under the correct statute. Those are the two things listed there. Here, it is a reasonable probability that the applicant is entitled to relief based on additional factual submissions. So those are two different questions. Yes, they are the same standard, but they are not the same thing. And there is no support in the statute or elsewhere indicating that those two things, that second part is just supposed to be a, oops, we made a mistake in the screening process. That's just not what the provision says.
I appreciate that. I see that. So that the substantive criteria at issue in paragraph 2 is different from the earlier.
It is, and I think it's important to note this is the state's first opportunity to chime in. We didn't get to say anything at step 1. We don't get to say anything at step 1. And so this is the first time the court gets an opportunity to look at the state's position with additional submissions. So it's just a different, yes, the test is reasonable probability, but those are the only similarities between those two things is the use of the word reasonable probability. One is the screening process, and the other is exactly what it says, that there is not a reasonable probability based on additional information or submissions that the applicant is entitled to relief. I see that I am running out of time. Unless there are any additional questions, I would just ask that you affirm Judge Quam's order. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
All right, to start, I just want to mention that in Judge Quam's order, he never found that there was not a reasonable, that we didn't prove a reasonable probability. That's a lower standard than the preponderance of the evidence. There's no finding saying petitioner hasn't established by a reasonable probability that he's entitled to relief. Instead, Judge Quam applied the preponderance of the evidence standard, which is higher. So there's nothing in this record that says that we didn't establish it by a preponderance of the evidence. So
I was just about to ask you whether the district judge used the word preponderance and sort of, you know, asked or and answered the question whether petitioner had satisfied his burden of proof, and I couldn't see it in the order. Can you point me to it?
Yeah, so there's no page number, but on the analysis section, it describes the law, and then it says is entitled to relief if and vacated to be resentenced if they show by a preponderance of the evidence that they did not cause the death of a human being and were not a major participant, and then goes through both of those.
Is this above heading Roman 1 or mm-hmm. below?
Yeah, so it says analysis, and then that first paragraph is the only discussion of the law.
Okay.
And describes the preponderance of the evidence standard and then applies that and then says we're not entitled to relief. So
well, now, I was going to ask where did the district judge apply that to this case?
Well, it's the only standard that the judge articulated. And then it's the only standard that the judge applied the facts to, and it's the only standard that the judge made any sort of findings. So if there was a finding in here that said petitioner hasn't established by a reasonable probability that he's entitled to relief, then we could argue about that. But he never made that finding, and that's a lower standard, and there's just no finding.
Seems like we have neither. We have neither the words reasonable probability or the words preponderance of the evidence in the application.
In the order? The order says this is the standard I'm applying, and that applies.
I see the standard, but like in the conclusion of the order on the last page, it'd be nice for an appellate judge if the district judge would couch the language in terms of exactly what the legal standard is. And so there the judge does not say Mr. Grant failed to prove by preponderance of the evidence that dot, dot, dot.
But it also doesn't say that Mr. Graham failed to establish by reasonable probability and never even mentioned that standard or that provision.
I agree.
Okay, so let me get into another reason why it's so important that we have hearings in this case, in these cases, and why it's different than post-conviction review. This is not a challenge to a conviction. There's a new accomplice liability statute under 60905. This is the first time that it is being applied to these cases. None of this was litigated before. It's never been litigated whether my client was a major participant. It was never litigated regarding whether he acted with extreme indifference to human life. The legislature wanted these individuals to get into court, to have their day in court under this new statute.
It was never litigated because?
Because it's a different 60905. The legislature amended 60905 in 2023 to include this exception. So any new aiding and abetting felony murder case, the state has to prove that the defendant was not a major participant and or was a major participant and did not act or acted with extreme indifference to human life. We've never had our day in court on that. This is not us going back on post-conviction review challenging a district court's order. We need the opportunity to present this evidence. And the way the legislature wrote the statute was you file your petition and you have a hearing. And just off the top of my head, in Olmsted County, Scott County, Mille Lacs County, Steele County, Beltrami County, and Ramsey County, we've filed these petitions and we've had hearings. We've walked into court and made arguments and presented evidence.
And that's the judge making that decision.
The judge, so we filed.
In those cases, ask for a hearing.
No.
The judge made the decision.
The judge read the statute.
That certainly isn't binding on us in terms of our, the record. This is just your anecdotal statement.
Absolutely. Certainly not binding on anyone. My point is, the way that this statute is written, if you read the plain language of it, the reply brief is filed, you look at provision one, and you say, did the state agree? Nope, the state didn't agree. Okay, let's go to provision two. Did they establish by a reasonable probability? Should we go back and revisit the preliminary application? No. Let's go to three. Okay, we schedule a hearing. And the idea that we needed to submit affidavits and articulate arguments within our memorandum to establish why we need a hearing, that's not supported by anything in the new law. There's no burden that we have to meet. There's no standard. There's nothing that the court would look at to say he gets a hearing, he doesn't get a hearing, because that's not what the legislature wanted or intended. The legislature intended that everyone gets their day in court and is able to present their case to the judge to establish these two factors.
Can you remind me, I think the argument was reasonable probability, yes, that term is used both at application petition phase, but it's a reasonable probability of X at one stage and reasonable probability of Y, which is entitlement to relief at the petition. What's the application stage say? A reasonable probability of what?
That isn't so.
Do you have the language? I just don't have it.
Yeah, so our position is it's the same standard. It's reasonable probability.
I mean, I'm asking what the session law says.
It says reasonable probability that he is entitled to relief.
In both cases?
In both positions, both parts. Our position is that under subdivision one, which states the purpose of the legislature's intent, that it says anyone, uses the word anyone, who is convicted of felony murder as an accomplice is entitled to petition the court for relief. So if you're convicted under the right statute and you're in custody, then that's the reasonable probability under the preliminary application process. And this is just revisiting that within the petition process.
Any other questions from the panel? No? All right.
Last argument of the day. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for your very helpful briefing and arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. And with that, we are in recess.
All rise.